Our next case this morning is Wojtas against Capital Guardian Trust. Mr. Byron.
May it please the court, my name is Craig Byron. I'm here representing the plaintiffs, Richard and Bonnie Wojtas. As the court is aware, this case arises out of the transfer of IRA funds from Capital Guardian to a successor custodian who was not qualified by the IRS as an IRA custodian. As a result, my client was built out of substantial funds in a well-known Ponzi scheme. Two claims were presented to the court below, that of breach of fiduciary duty and common law negligence. All claims were dismissed by the court on the basis of a perceived failure to meet the statute of limitations. There was no defense posed to the statute of limitations argument as it relates to the breach of fiduciary duty claims, as there was no meritorious defense to those claims. However, despite what counsel for the appellee indicates, there was no argument below that the common law negligence claims were subject to the statute of limitations. It was not argued, nor could I contemplate that they would argue that those claims were subject to a 2-year statute of limitations. What was argued in their briefs was that the court should recognize the common law negligence claims as essentially cloaked breach of fiduciary duty claims, and therefore dismiss them as if they were breach of fiduciary duty claims. On pages 5 and 6 of their briefs that were filed in the underlying action, that's number 15 in the record, it says, nor can Wojtas avoid the 2-year statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty claims by attaching a negligence label to her claim. Wojtas's negligence is nothing more than a reiteration of her breach of fiduciary claim by another name. And they go on to say, any claim based upon alleged breach of fiduciary duty, regardless of the label given to the cause of action, are time barred under Wisconsin's 2-year statute of limitations. Now, if the underlying court had made that determination that our common law negligence claims were in fact a cloaked breach of fiduciary duty claim brought under common law negligence, I would not be here making this argument. However, there was no such finding. There was no determination under Rule 12b-6 of any of the negligence claims. The court simply stated that all claims were dismissed with prejudice.
Well, the court did that on statute of limitations grounds, though, so implicit in that ruling is that both claims were asserting the same legal theory of breach of fiduciary duty, and that was subject to the 2-year statute, and since there was no defense offered on the statute of limitations, that was the end of the story.
Well, there was a defense that was posed asserting that there was and should be liability under common law negligence, and the fact of the matter is that they were pled under common law negligence, and the court should not allow Capital to simply state that because Wisconsin, under Wisconsin law, breach of fiduciary duty is limited to obligations under the contract, that they can't have any liability whatsoever for any errors or omissions. And we have a structure in place under the IRS rules, under Regulation 1.408 sub 2E, and those regulations provide that an IRS custodian has to be qualified by the Internal Revenue Service. They have to meet certain financial qualifications. They have to show that they're worthy of having that status bestowed upon them, and at a minimal inquiry, a transferring IRA custodian should make that inquiry. There's a notice that's issued to an approved IRA custodian. They have to have that notice in order to receive funds. At a minimum, a transferring IRA custodian should make that inquiry and say, can we see your notice?
What is the rule that requires that inquiry?
It's regulation 1.408-2.
No, that's the rule that says that your IRA doesn't get the benefit of tax deferral without that qualification. What is the rule that requires the transferor custodian to inquire into the transferee's status?
There is no such rule, Your Honor.
So this whole lawsuit rests on thin air.
No, Your Honor. It's. I don't think that the court can assume that this IRS regulation is out there in thin air. I mean,
look, as I said, you have to meet certain standards if you're a custodian for the income on particular investments not to be immediately taxed. There's a requirement for tax deferral. That's conceptually a completely separate question from whether somebody who pays money over in a way that costs the transferee tax benefits is violating some rule.
Your Honor,
what is the rule that requires the transferor to inquire? But I guess I shouldn't pursue that. You've already conceded there is none.
There is no statutory rule. But along the lines of what the court was saying, in this case, yes, my client was bilked out of the entirety of the funds. But as you were indicating, there is a tax consequence that if funds are transferred over to an IRA custodian who is not qualified, that results in a taxable transaction to the holder of the IRA. And at a minimum, I think a reasonable IRA custodian would look at the situation and say, look, we have an obligation to our clients here, and we should look at this, and we should make sure that we are not turning money over to somebody who's not qualified, because otherwise that could result in a taxable transaction to that person, and or it could result in this type of situation where you have somebody who is bilking people out of lots of money.
Is that an obligation to warn or an obligation to refuse to transfer?
I think that there should be a... I think either would have been sufficient in this case.
Well, yeah, if you say they have an obligation, but what is it, if any?
I think the obligation should be to verify that the successor custodian is qualified.
In hindsight, that would have been a nice thing to have.
It's a minimal inquiry, Your Honor.
But if you're told, if the trustee or whatever it is, the person, the beneficiary of this, tells to transfer it for whatever reason, does that require an inquiry, or does it require just you transfer? It's like a bank account or something. You know, do you transfer it to pay for something? Do you say, well, wait a minute, that may be a lousy investment, or what do you do?
Well, I think the obligation of the transferring custodian would be limited to drawing the attention to the client that, look, the successor custodian is not qualified under the IRS, and this could result in a taxable transaction to you. And, you know, obviously they are not in a position to make any determination after that fact, but that is a minimal inquiry, and I'm saying that a reasonable custodian that is in charge of handling people's life savings should make that minimal inquiry and make that communication to the client.
Of course, all of this is bypassed because it was taken out on statute of limitations. You don't get to the merits about what obligations they had.
Yes, and there was no determination on those merits, Your Honor, and there's absolutely nothing in the underlying court's orders to suggest that they considered anything as far as the merits of the negligence claims, nor is there anything to suggest that they agreed with counsel for the appellee that this was a cloaked breach of fiduciary duty claim. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that the court made any type of determination whatsoever other than stating that as a matter of law that the negligence claims were subject to...
Is there some central repository, some central list of people who are qualified to manage tax-deferred plans where they're registered?
That's my understanding that the IRS does maintain such a list, Your Honor.
that can be searched online, for example?
Yes.
Okay.
To reserve the balance of any time that I may have for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Byron.
Thank you.
Mr. Nichols.
May it please the court, Steve Nichols on behalf of Capital Guardian. There really are three issues here. First, Ms. Wotus's claims are time-barred no matter what label she attaches to the claim. Two, in any event, she failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted based on the explicit language of the agreement between the parties here. And three, dismissal with prejudice was therefore appropriate because both the statute of limitations defense and the failure to state a claim are substantive defenses warranting dismissal with prejudice. I want to talk first about this statute of limitations, and particularly this waiver issue. Quite frankly, I'm a little bit surprised by the position they're taking that the negligence claims were never addressed in terms of being time-barred. Attorney Byron himself read the paragraph from our brief where we explicitly argued that the negligence claim was also subject to the two-year statute of limitations because it was nothing more than a relabeling of the breach of fiduciary duty claim. That was crystal clear. We reiterated that position in two subsequent briefs. One was our response to their motion to dismiss, and another was our reply brief on our motion for judgment on the pleadings. They never responded to the argument. In fact, they had wrote a final brief, what they called their supplemental brief, in support of their motion to dismiss. That came after we had filed all three of ours. Even then, they did not respond to it. Judge Shabazz correctly noted that their acquiescence constituted a waiver, and therefore the statute of limitations applied to both breach of fiduciary duty and negligence. In addition, Attorney Byron just said that there was never any discussion at all by the court as to whether the negligence claim was subject to this two-year statute. In fact, Attorney Byron wrote a letter to the court saying, based on your order, it's not clear whether the negligence claim is also barred by the statute of limitations. The court subsequently issued a judgment saying all of the claims, and there were only two, all of the claims against Capital are dismissed with prejudice. This issue was before the court. It was addressed. The only party who never addressed it was the plaintiffs. I want to talk now about their failure to state a claim. We just heard some discussion about what
is
sort of
there a central repository of people who are authorized, who have properly registered to manage tax-deferred funds?
And not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Yeah, I just don't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Byron says so. I've just tried to find it on the IRS website. It wasn't. Either it isn't there or my search skills aren't up to par.
I'm not aware if there is, but if there is one that's searchable, in this instance, plaintiffs themselves could have searched that before making this transfer. What's key here is the language in the agreement. Section 10 of the agreement specifically discusses when the custodial relationship is terminated. And under Section 10, it says that the owner of the account, in this case Ms. Wotus, is the one who selects selects the new custodian. Capital's only duty in this situation was to pay those funds over to the new custodian. That's the only duty Capital had. And Ms. Wotus, in the complaint, admits that's exactly what Capital did. The complaint is very clear.
Does Capital have a benefit in retaining the investment? Does it have a fee that it collects or something?
I don't know the answer to that question. I assume
the reason
that
I ask is it against their interest to transfer it?
Oh, not that I'm aware of.
Well, I mean monetary interest and gain. Do they lose a client, in effect, or does that matter?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know whether they would have given up ongoing fees by transferring it. I mean, I assume they're paid something, although it could be a one-time fee up front. But it may also be an annual or a periodic fee that is charged as custodian. And you're right. by transferring to a new custodian, they would have lost, to the extent there was a periodic fee, they would have lost that fee. But paragraphs 17 and 23 of the complaint are very clear, and they say, at plaintiff's request, Capital transferred the money over to the successor custodian. That's exactly what the agreement here, that's exactly the duty that Capital had under the agreement here. Plaintiff concedes that was done. So the issue then is, was Judge Shabazz's dismissal with prejudice appropriate? Absolutely, for both of the reasons here. This failure to state a claim is an absolute legal bar to the claims. That's true whether these causes of action are filed in Wisconsin, Illinois, or anywhere else. But in addition, the statute of limitations in Wisconsin is a complete substantive defense. It does not merely bar the remedy in Wisconsin. It extinguishes the claim entirely. And thus, so for that reason alone, a statute of limitations defense in Wisconsin does not allow a party to refile in some other jurisdiction. So both failure to state a claim and the statute of limitations defense were complete substantive defenses that warrant dismissal with prejudice. If Your Honors do not have any questions. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Nicholas. Mr. Byron, anything further?
Yes, sir.
You could start by telling me where I can find this database.
I couldn't tell you now. I know that early on in this case that I did locate a repository of names that were of qualified IRA custodians. Where it was found, I cannot tell you. It's quite some time ago. But I do know that, you know, as part of the regulatory procedure, the qualified custodian...
So you're withdrawing your suggestion that you know it's maintained by the IRS.
I don't know that it's maintained by the IRS. Yeah, no. I'd just like to briefly address the issue of whether or not this matter should be dismissed with prejudice or without. I think this court has always demanded that the lower courts adhere to precedent. There's no authority of the lower courts to reject a doctrine developed by a higher court that was stated by this court in Shore versus O'Leary. There's a societal interest in an orderly and predictable application of the legal rules. In this case, we have the Bolton decision cited in the brief that talks about the fact that it's error to deny a motion to dismiss without prejudice under Rule 41A sub 2 because of a statute of limitations defense.
Bolton mm-hmm. was substantially, if not completely, overruled in Grivas.
Well, what it was
later commented on in Adney. Both cases refer to Bolton as no longer good law.
Well, it's good law to the extent that a statute of limitations defense is not a valid reason to deny a motion to dismiss without prejudice. What has been qualified in Bolton is whether or not the plaintiff has an absolute right to a dismissal without prejudice. And to the extent that I may have suggested that that's the case in my brief, I apologize. That wasn't my intention. It was my intention to cite that Bolton remains controlling precedent, that the fact that a defendant may have to face a subsequent lawsuit in another jurisdiction because there's a statute of limitations that extends the right to pursue the claim in another jurisdiction, that is not a basis for a court to deny a motion to dismiss without prejudice. I see my time is up. Thank mm-hmm. you. Unless you have other questions.
Yes. Thank you, counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We'll hear argument.